2015, the ocean is plastic. Plastic is affecting over 800 marine species. There is a lot of talk about the harm the plastic are doing to the oceans generally. But what about coral reefs specifically? So in Hong Kong, scientists made a 3D printed reefs. And they place them on the ocean floor in hope that they will rejuvenate or enhance corals that are dying. Maybe Dr. Rowe know more about it.
Nothing specific. I mean, you could read about it and watch documentaries about it. There's a lot of concern about coral reefs, ecosystems, and other such being destroyed. They're discovering a few coral reefs that we didn't know about, which is nice. Hopefully those won't get destroyed as well.
Mushrooms were found as a warning network to other trees. 2 decades ago, while researching her doctoral thesis, ecologist Susan Smirold discovered that trees communicate their needs and send each other nutrients via a network of latticed fungi buried in the soil. In other words, she found they talk to each other. Since then, Smirold, now at University of British Columbia, has pioneered future research and further research into the how trees converse, including how those fungal finger grease help trees send warning signals about environment change and search for kin and transfer their nutrients to neighboring plants before they die. So we thought that a green cannot have too much of a conversation between themselves, and I believe there is another approach to it. By using phrases like forest wisdom or mother trees, when she speaks about the elaborate system, the scientist compares the neural network in human brains to the fine interaction between plants. A forest is cooperative system, and they use the language of communication that has more sense than we thought it has. And to HJN, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I mean, rather than say talk, you know, I could understand that that's going to give a lot more clicks if the article on the internet. It's exchanging information, and pretty much all cells on one level or another exchange information. The reason why your cells don't overgrow their location and you end up being lumpy and such is because each cell abutting it, you know, transmits some signal that it's there. And that's the equilibrium state. So you get a cut, there's no longer that signal being done, the cells replicate, and that's another means of exchanging information. In the same way that when your cat is hungry and comes up to you and meows at you, it doesn't really mean your cat is talking to you, but it is exchanging information.
Okay. Fungi and bacteria play an integral role in the earth. They break down complex organic compounds of proteins, carbohydrates, and fats into their most basic elements that can be used by other generations of organisms. Plants don't have mouths or stomachs. They rely on soil, fungi, and bacteria to digest nutrients from them. In return, they feed soil organisms with sugars they make in photosynthesis. Let me go to another subject. And this one is very interesting, very much promising to our health. We have a work of scientists creating 1 millimeter or lower or lesser than that robot. So think about rectangular structure with two magnets, and in the middle you have a piece of plastic, and we can place on it a special medicine or medication that's supposed to be delivered not to the whole organism where other organs will suffer, but it has to go to the particular part and exactly particular pinpointed place. That would be good for cancer research, but that would be also good for any other form of treating with medication. Let me drop. I should have an article for it. A rectangular robot as thin as human hairs can travel throughout a clone by doing back flips. So it's like a flipping. Purdue University engineers have demonstrated that in live animals model. They also experimented with pigs, and they found that 97% successful, so in delivering medication either to a very pinpointed place of the organ, so when they're talking about the pinpointed, they're talking that the spot that this robot has to be delivered is at the size of the robot. So the first one that was 1 millimeter in size now is smaller, is as big as the human hair. So why the back flips? Because the goal is to use those robots to transport drugs in humans whose clones and other organs have rough terrain. Slight flips work too. Why a backflipping robot transport drugs? Well, getting a drug directly to its target site could remove side effects such as hair loss or stomach bleeding that the drug may otherwise cause by interacting with other organs along the way. And we have a Journal of Micromachines. There is a article there. And those in vivo biological systems are in use today. As far as I know, they haven't been approved for the human to be work yet, but at least it works there. So in the short words, how it works, we have a XYZ magnetic field outside the organism. And we are, a doctor is looking at that robot or set of robots through the ultrasound, and they see those robots traveling, and then he is simply flipping the field in that is turning those robots in the XYZ magnetic field that is outside and is delivered to that robot. Dr. Ray.
Okay, I mean, medical science has been working on delivery systems, as you mentioned. If you pour stuff just in a vein or in a person's stomach, it gets systemically absorbed and can have more side effects in different regions of the body that you don't want to deal with this chemical. So delivery systems have been continuing to be proposed and looked at and experimented. I don't know if this is the magic bullet, But, you know, more technology is always better than less. It probably requires a lot more engineering before it becomes a particularly practical approach.
Yeah, the team conducted an in vivo experiment in clones. Okay, that was the micro robots. The micro robots could also tremble in clones exercise from pigs. The researchers found which have similar guts to humans. So yes, that's a very much promising technology. Any questions? And I believe we have a last. Harvard scientists think they have pinpointed the physical source of consciousness. The thing is that a Department of Police in Arizona, they decided to train a police officer's subconsciousness. And that was because they could have a more safety operation, and at the same time, a police officer would not spend too much time on thinking whether the decision he is making right. Despite advantages in neuroscience, we still don't really know where it comes from and what really is subconsciousness. Dr. Roy, how would you describe subconsciousness?
Well, it's a very, very complicated field. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about any of this. We have a new invention, a functional MRI, which demonstrates where metabolic rates increase, and we perceive that these heightened metabolic rates are due to heightened neural activity, and we approximate the location and try and figure things out. So far, the way that they seem to think it runs is consciousness is not kind of located in any one little place. It's more of an emergent global phenomena that comes from the interplay of a whole bunch of different systems operating simultaneously in everyone's brain. We don't have a conscious link to all of these processes. We only have a link to some of them, and there's a bit of a time delay because processing requires delay. So your brain works at least about 200 or 300 milliseconds faster than your consciousness of the events. The things that you think are right now are actually 200 or 300 milliseconds ago. But because your subconscious can act anyway, even before it hits the consciousness, it does. Then you have to kind of make up a good reason why you did that, even though you don't know, because it wasn't really your conscious you, it was your subconscious you. So the subconscious is a much less latency delayed, less processing, with less connections to your consciousness, part of your mental function. And that subconscious, the conscious is a smaller group that you're aware of and in control of. And we don't like to be out of control, so people don't like to think of the subconscious as a different part of our brain that isn't completely hardwired to the conscious part.
So we have our scientists in New York, and they found a connection between the brainstream region involved in arousal and regions involved in awareness, the prerequisites for consciousness. And it was Beth Israel Medical Center. I believe they are at Harvard Medical School, or at least there is a branch in New York of them. I'm not sure. The Harvard team identified not only the specific brain STEAM region linked to arousal, but also two cortex regions that are all appear to work together to form consciousness. And now we have a result of an experiment to figure this out. The team analyzed 36 patients in a hospital with brainstem lesions. 12 of them were in coma, unconscious, and 24 were defined as being conscious. The researchers then mapped their brain stems to figure out if there was one particular region that could explain why some patients had maintained consciousness despite their injuries, while others had become comatose. What they found was one small area of brain stem known as that was significantly associated with coma. Then 10 out of 12 unconscious patients had damage in this area, while just 1 out of 24 conscious patients did. That suggests that this tiny region of the brainstem is important for consciousness, but it is not full story. They found that there is a certain brain map of healthy human which shows all different connections that we know so far in our brains. So those scientists identified two areas in cortex that were linked up to the dorsolateral pontine tegmentum, and were most likely to play a role regulating consciousness. Anyhow, coming back to the subject, we have a discovery of a mechanism that is ruling with subconscious and action of police departments is now to use that mechanism to train police officers in it. And to XG, end of story.
Well, I wish them good luck. Vigilance and awareness is very important. Most people get it from a brisk bit of exercise, others by a cup of coffee, whatever floats one's boat. But again, more information is always better than less. So it's coming up to 10:20, Wes. It's going to be time to move on.
Okay, I just finished. Just a few more lines. The 200 patrol officers in Cleveland Police Department will undergo training to recognize their subconscious biases using a simulator developed by assistant professor of College of Nursing, WSU. What is WSU?
Could be Washington State University. I don't know. There's a lot of things that can stand for WSU.
That is correct. The large-scale training is a part of $750,000 research grant awarded to National Institute of Justice and the Research and Development Agency, United States Department of Justice. So we now see that patrol officers in Cleveland Police Department will be more educated in subconscious reaction. I try to be gentle and to exhale.
Well, I certainly hope that they do that.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wesley. And again, I want to remind people, if you have any topics you would like to hear discussed or mailbag questions because you can't get onto the TechNet, or you want me to pass on something to Paul. Email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And links will be available. There's some illustrations that Paul sent me that I put up on my link page, so please take a look. Just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that will get you to the link page. And now let me call upon Paul, WS2N, for this Sunday's SpaceNet report.
AC2GS, WS2N. And very good. Yeah, we'll do that. 9:30, we had a nice storm come through here. I mean, what a line. That line of storm was from, like, below Atlantic City all the way up into Massachusetts. And we were, like, in the middle of it. And sure enough, my phone, my computer, everything came up with a warning that there was a tornado. Yeah, possible tornado. I haven't seen that ever pop up on my phone, you know. But that was interesting. And right now, I just looked at it. It looks like it's just passed Riverhead. So, I don't know. Did you see anything like that near you, Roy? I mean, this thing came through. I thought it was weakening, but by the time I got out here, boy, it was very powerful. We had high winds, heavy rain. Well, I'm glad that's gone. In fact, I, you know, talk about unplugging radios. I don't unplug the antennas anymore, but I will shut them off. Worried about the power going out and back on again with a surge. More of a problem from PSE&G than I am worried about a lightning bolt, you know, destroying the electronics and TVs and radios. So I shut it off and I listened to part of it, and that with an HT. But now we're back on. So okay, let me just review what I saw tonight on TV, watching the SpaceX Crew Dragon, Crew One Dragon vehicle takeoff. This was a spacecraft that's taking up four people in one shot up to the International Space Station. There's three people up there now, so that would be a total of seven. And I've talked about these four going up week after week. And Shannon Walker, KD5DXB, Michael Hopkins, another astronaut, that's the ham, KF5LJG, Victor Glover, KI5BKC, and Nagoshi is KD5NVP. He's from the Japan Space Agency. So they successfully got off the ground at 7:27, roughly 7:30 tonight, half hour before the net. They rode the Falcon 9 rocket, which has nine Merlin D engines on the booster, producing 1.7 million pounds of thrust. But it's interesting, you know, how they board the rocket. They have an area in the Armstrong Building that they don their spacesuits, big white spacesuits. Much more easy to walk around and maneuver in than the older ones that NASA, the old orange ones that NASA would put people in on the space shuttle. So they actually get into a car to drive the 20-minute ride from the Armstrong Building to the launch complex. And the cars they get into are Tesla cars, naturally, because SpaceX is owned by Elon Musk. Support crew. But the other two, they put the four astronauts in each one, so two in each car, with the gullwing doors, and they close. and off they go, and they ride up to the 250-foot level. And, you know, at the building to board the spacecraft. They have this access arm, this 80-foot-long access arm that goes out. It's all enclosed, very modern-looking thing as they walk through it. Glass, you know, it's not like the old days where it was exposed, you know, to the atmosphere. You just, you know, walk through this tunnel-like with windows. And they get to the white room. They still call it the white room. The old days, they used to always call it the white room. That's like the ready room right before they get into the spacecraft, where they have technicians helping people get in. And they put the four astronauts into the Dragon, and they got ready to go. And by the way, they named the new vehicle Resilience. That's the name, you know, they chose the name. It'll probably keep that, you know, that name. This is a reusable spacecraft. This will be the first one for this flight. Now, if this sounds familiar, back in May they launched a similar setup. The only difference, that was a test flight to the International Space Station with two people. And they were both hams as well, Hurley and Bob Benjamin. So they only spent a couple of months on the station, and they wanted to make sure everything worked out okay. From what I understand, they took all the measurements of what went on before they left, when they docked to the space station, when they came back, and took a evaluation of what needed to be changed, and they changed two important items for the. For this new flight. So each flight they gain experience, and everything went well with that previous flight, and this one here everything was going well until they closed the door. They closed the hatch, and then they usually take a pressure reading, make sure everything's airtight, and sure enough the pressure meter was starting to drop, so they knew they had a slight leak. And they opened up the door again. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking down, but they had time to open up the door. They checked the seal, they put the four lubricant on, and they did find a foreign object debris. They didn't say what it was, but something was in the air, laying on the gasket. And, they cleaned it all up, and sure enough, at 7:27, they launched to the space station. The space craft for a little over a day, 27 hours. Tomorrow night at around 11 o'clock, they'll dock with the International Space Station. They'll connect to the pressure mating adapter number 2. That's been up there like since the beginning. That's what the shuttles used to dock to. But then to make it more modern, for these modern adapters, for docking, they upgraded the pressure mating adapter over the years. During one flight, they brought up something called the IDA, International Docking Adapter, which is, it's sort of like just an adapter to adapt to the new system that any vehicle flying to the space station will use in the future. So that's what will happen tomorrow. I'll watch that tomorrow night at 11 o'clock. So that was glad to see it get off successfully. They're going to spend 6 months up there, like the last test crew that went up there just spent the 2 months. And now they'll spend 4 days, 6 months up there with these four people. And I was glad to see, right after the launch, Joe Biden, he sent out a message congratulating the launch, and said congratulations to NASA and SpaceX on today's launch. It's a testament to the power of science, and that's what I like to hear, science, and what we can accomplish by harnessing our innovation, ingenuity, and determination. I join all Americans and the people of Japan in wishing the astronauts Godspeed and on their journey. He even made a note of the fellow from Japan, who speaks better English than me, by the way. He's very well spoken. He's been on three different flights. In fact, he's been on, this is his third flight, and each one was a different rocket for him. He first flew on a shuttle years ago, and then eventually went up on a Soyuz rocket, spent half a year on the space station. And now he's going up on a Falcon 9 booster with a Dragon spacecraft on top. So that's the story. Any questions on this particular mission, which I consider historic? It's the first of the rotational missions that they're going to have. So every, like, you know, maybe twice a year, they'll be sending four people up to the International Space Station to make a permanent crew of seven, by the way, instead of a permanent crew of six. This is WS-1.
Yeah, WB2KWC.
Good evening, Sam. How are you? And I got to see this. It was on a couple of stations. I saw it on C-SPAN. C-SPAN, they do great. And no commercials. How you doing, Sam?
Doing excellent, Paul. Hope you are as well. Yeah, I watched it on SpaceX. TV. Am I correct in understanding they're going to be, I saw them sitting in there. It looks like for four people, there's not a lot of room. They're going to be stuck sitting in those seats and those chairs for over 24 hours. Is that what I understand?
Yeah, 27 hours. But, you know, they won't be in the seats. They'll be floating around. I guess they could. The seats, you know, are motorized. They go out of that. You know, they'll move. They'll put them into a different location. There's an area below where those seats are. In fact, it's big enough where you could put three more seats. This thing was designed to fly seven people. But yeah, they're going to be eating and sleeping at some point in the next day. Originally, they were going to fly yesterday, and there was some weather constraints, so they couldn't fly. So that would have been, I think, a two orbit deal. I think 6 or 7 hours it would have taken to get to the space station. And this one, you know, it's a little different depending on the orbital mechanics. What happens is when that space station is directly overhead, that's when they launch. And if it's a little off one way or the other, they have to make up for that. That takes a little longer. So, yeah, that's what they're going to do. Let me drop it. And one of the four, I forget which guy it was. By the way, these are three guys and one woman. I forget which guy it is. One of the three. Because there's only so many bunks, let's call them bunks, in the International Space Station. There's only room for six people. So one guy's going to stay in there. So back to you, Sam. KC1SAM, WS2.
Yeah, I didn't realize they had all that room below the seat. You don't see that much when you're just looking at the TV and what they show you. I'm looking at it and saying, that's a little cramped, but, you know, a couple of hours, what the hell. They have room, they can get up and stretch their legs and everything, you know. All right, so it's not quite as bad. Well, it's not bad at all if you have that extra space, you know.
Alright.
And one guy who sleeps in there. He has his own private room. Thank you, Paul. Best over to you.
Okay, wait for the ID to go by. And, yeah. They're going to be very happy to be where they are. And that vehicle, you know, that could stay up there for quite a few days if they had to. You know, if there was a problem, like, with docking or something. You'll notice the outside of the spacecraft is called the trunk. The whole thing, top to bottom, is 27 feet high. And roughly half of it is spacecraft, and the other half is what they call the trunk. And that feeds their power and, it's got oxygen, and it's got everything you need to survive, but, you know, the environmental situation inside the spacecraft. So the trunk, one half of it has all solar panels, and then the other half has radiate panels. So, in space, very hard to get rid of the heat. You know, people's, all the electronics and everything inside a spacecraft. A lot of heat gathers, and they're always so well insulated that you can't get rid of the heat. So they have these radiators, and that'll be on, that's on half the trunk, the bottom part of the spacecraft. And then the other half, you'll see, it's all black, and that's all solar panels. So the original cargo Dragons that were going up, they've done up over 20 times. At all, regular solar panels that would open up, four panels on each side. And now they've done away with that. In fact, they've actually done away with that on the cargo vehicles themselves. The ships are mounted on the body. I think they can get, I think I remember 4 kW out of the panels. I believe that was one of the upgrades that they made too from the last flight. They used better panels. Now, this thing was supposed to fly originally in October, the end of October. But they realized that they had problems with a couple of the engines. When they were doing static tests, pressure in one of the engines. So they took the engines out, brought them back to McGregor, Texas, and put it, make it test all these things. Like a little vent port, that was clogged from another manufacturer that was part of the cleaning process. Engines were being made, wound up getting this sticky stuff, similar to nail file polish, fogging up on a couple of these holes, and they found it in a couple of the other engines, so they corrected all of that. That's why they were able to take off a couple of weeks later than right now.
Well, you have static filters settling.
Okay, Sam, thanks. And I hear it on yours as well, so my guess is the repeater. I went higher in power. How's this?
I can hear you better.
Did you say better or not any better?
No, I can hear you better. You're punching through it a little bit better.
Yeah, so you're getting noisy, and you're booming in. Maybe I should switch over to Glen Oaks. I don't know. Roy, what do you think? ACTGS WS2N.
Well, it's up to you. It's about 30% noise and crackles and such. If you want to try your other, the other repeater, I'll tell you which is better.
Okay, let me move the antenna. Stand by. Okay, let's see. AC2GSWS2N, how's this?
This is much, much better.
That's why it's good to always have a backup. Backup to the backup. So, okay. All right, let me just switch over to this surveyor story. I don't know if you've read, anybody read about this. Apparently, there's this, a scientific group using a telescope. I'm trying to think what state they were in. But they were using their telescopes, and they're always tracking, they're always looking for asteroids. I think it's part of the NASA group. Anyway, they saw something that they were wondering about, and they gave it an asteroid number and all. But as time went on, they looked at the orbit, and they realized the orbit was exactly in line with the orbit of Earth, where asteroids tend to be a little off-kilter. You know, the inclination is always just slightly different. This thing was, like, right on the money. So they started to think, well, maybe this is piece of space junk, that was launched years ago, and they researched it, and they figured out that this thing is the second stage of a rocket that launched one of the Surveyor missions to the moon, and turns out this is a large stage. It's a Centaur upper stage. They still use them today. Of course, they're more modernized. They're liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket, that's used for the second stage. And the Surveyor missions were launched in the 60s. And this particular one was launched in 1966. And the idea was to land on the moon. This is after the orbiter missions had taken place. We launched orbiters around the moon, and then we launched the Ranger missions. The Ranger missions were designed to just crash into the moon. And they would take pictures all the way down until they hit the moon. And then they came up with the Surveyor missions. They launched a half a dozen of them. Two of them didn't make it, but four did. Four of them did. The second one that was launched did not make it. And it lost control and it wound up crashing into the moon. But the second stage that it was attached to kept on going, and it wound up. Going all the way, not only to the moon, but past the moon, into solar orbit. And this thing's been going into solar orbit for not only years, but for decades, back in 1966. Sure enough, this thing has now returned, and it's heading toward Earth. And they finally figured out that this thing was not an asteroid, but it is a second stage. Now, it looks like it's going to orbit the Earth just once. It's going to go around, and then as it comes around again, it's going to pick up speed from the gravity of the Earth, and it's going to actually go back into solar orbit again. So there's no chance of recovering it. Radio's making noise. I hope I'm making it. Probably not. How's the signal, Roy?
It's pretty good. You know, I mean, it's not full quieting, but I understand everything you say, and there's no terrible hiss or crackle. Really?
Okay, we'll go with this. You know, that's the reason sometimes I always switch over to Zeldin. But Zeldin's no good for some reason. Even Sam was noisy, and he never is. So, I set the picture of what this thing looks like. It's a larger second stage, and the picture is from the actual booster that was, you know, somebody took a picture of it back in 1966 when it was in the assembly building before it was, you know, mated with the Surveyor. So that's the story on that. I always liked the Surveyor mission. That's the one with Surveyor 3 was good. That was the one that landed successfully on the moon. And, you know, it had solar panels and cameras. Had a digging arm. And, you know, they were all pretty good. And, I mean, at the time, we weren't even sure if these vehicles were going to sink into the moon if it was all dust or something. But they found out real quick. But it was a pretty solid place to land. The Surveyor 3, they decided when the Apollo 12 mission launched after 11, they wanted to see how, you know, pinpoint landing. Let's see how good we are. Let's see if we can get close to something that we've landed down there before. So they picked Surveyor 3. And sure enough, they got a couple hundred yards away when they landed. Pete Conrad and Bean, they were the two that landed. Alan Bean, they both went out on the EVA, walked over to the Surveyor, and NASA wanted them to bring something home, you know. I guess like a souvenir, and so they worked at it, and I think they brought the camera home, and the lens, they examined it when they got back. They looked at the lens, and they said, oh, there's some kind of bacteria there, and how could that be, you know? And they found out, after examining and testing, I think for like decades, they figured out that what it was some kind of bacteria that was actually on the lens before it was ever launched. So their dream of, like, you know, some kind of alien thing landing on the lens of the Surveyor was dashed. But that was a good story. I mean, amazing that they landed so close to Surveyor. And there's plenty of pictures. Of course, you go on the internet and see pictures of the astronauts standing near Surveyor 3. Any questions or comments? WS2.
AC2PO.
Your call went by kind of quick. Try again, please.
Sorry, Paul. Alpha Charlie 2, Papa Lima.
Very good. Okay. Okay, very good. You just said it quick. No, you got a great signal. AT2DLWS to win.
Your last comments were remarkable because literally just this evening at dinner, my daughter, my 12-year-old kid, was asking me if we send people out into interplanetary or interstellar travel, what's the probability that, this is a 12-year-old kid asking this question, what's the probability that a virus would be out there that they would contract? And the fact that we brought bacteria with us made me think that we obviously hadn't sanitized it well enough, and I wonder what the protocols are for, that they're thinking about anyway, for these big jumps in terms of sanitizing everyone and the equipment. and particularly getting rid of viruses, because as we all know, they harbor, our human body harbors a plenitude of viruses that that crop up later on. What are your comments on that? And actually, I wonder if Roy wanted to make a statement as well. That
that is a great question your daughter asked. You know, that, you know, how many people are going to wonder about the cleanliness and or how do they sterilize everything before it goes up? And they, of course, they've been doing it for decades. They've just gotten better at it. And I know a lot of products, a lot of pieces are actually heated, if you could heat it without any damage to the electronics. You go up to a certain temperature, and but they're all sterilized, and that's why you know if you see spacecraft being assembled, that's gonna, especially with the ones that are gonna land on a planet like Perseverance, that's on the way to Mars now, and Curiosity, that's on Mars. Those things were all sterilized, and, you know, the guys all had bunny suits on with the hats, and their shoes are completely covered. They, you know, you walk in there, they go through a couple of processes to get into that room itself. They're completely sterilized, I think twice in some cases. Like, I read a book about Hubble. They did that with Hubble too. It took like forever just for somebody to get into that room to work on it. But as far as actually something surviving from, you know, from Earth to the moon and back, I don't think it survived. I think whatever it was Roy would know, but it was there where they were able to see it on a microscope, on a lens of a camera. I don't know, ACTGS, WS2N, you want to take this?
Yeah, sure, AC2GS. Well, you know, I mean, the problem is if you keep it inorganic, you have a better chance of sterilizing. You just, you know, wreak havoc with ozone and UV lights and temperature shifts. The problem is if you introduce any organic material, you can't really sterilize it that much. Human bodies are mostly made up of bacterial cells and a lot of viral particles, and I don't know how you get rid of them all without impacting your health. I'm not that worried about alien viruses and such, because probably the DNA or their equivalent is different. I mean, there's a lot of very good Asimov type of science fiction you can write about. You know, creatures from outer space could have different molecular chirality, so that, you know, we can't digest their food, they can't digest our food. But also they could be using different chemical backbones. They could be using slightly different codons. It would be a mess. So, you know, it's kind of like the old science fiction where two aliens got together from two separate planets and had a little baby. It's not going to happen.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I can see that. AC2PL, how's that? Back to you. How's that answer from Roy?
it's a fantastic answer, and we could spend hours on it, but Roy and I will have to do that offline. I mean, it's the sort of thing where the kid's fascination with viruses is obvious. There's an obvious reason for that. And it really, I took it in a different direction when I spoke with her. I said that any organism that we run into out there in the depths of space is going to be beyond our imagination. It'll either be exactly what we imagined or something that we never possibly imagined. So I told her that it was probably going to be liquid ammonium, ammonia and communicating with each other from a solid ice core via gamma rays. So that really sent her off in a completely different direction. But anyway, thank you, gentlemen, for entertaining the question. AC2PL, back to that.
WG3AU, comment. Okay, WB2EAB, go ahead.
Historically, the concern has been less about other things latching onto us, as all the stuff we bring along with us by nature of our biology latching onto other things.
Yeah, how true. Some of the stuff that, you know, that's on the human body gets loose inside the International Space Station. And they always find it near the vents. You know, they have these intake vents and discharge vents, just like a house, you know. The intake filters tend to wind up with these weird, sometimes colored areas, and they're always cleaning it. And one of the tests that has been done over the last couple of years, or experiments, is this DNA sequencing. And the first time they did it was this lady, she's got a doctorate in biology, she's an astronaut, Kate Rubin. She was up there a couple of years ago, and the first person to sequence DNA. I remember asking Roy about it, and wound up with came to the conclusion that you'll be able to test something. You know, let's say you are flying to Mars and you see something, on the outside of the spacecraft. You know, you could bring it in and test it, and maybe figure out what it is if you have the capability of running a DNA sequencing. So, yeah, they're actually doing that. By the way, Kate Rubin is one of the astronauts that are up there on the International Space Station right now. She made a second trip not too long ago. So she'll be greeting the four astronauts that will be arriving tomorrow night. She's up there with the two Russians. She went up on a Soyuz spacecraft. Any other comments? This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
WB2KWC.
WB2KWC. Good evening, Ken. How you doing?
Hey, good evening, Paul. I'm doing well. Something that I have been wondering about for, I guess, a long time. Is about the, the launch rockets. To me, it seems that when this is done by the government or military, basically the rockets go up and they kind of are left to, plunge into the ocean and basically not be reused. But when we see people like SpaceX launching stuff, they launch it, and then they come down, and they kind of land either on land or a platform at sea and are reusable. I'm curious, is there an explanation for why, or am I just laboring under a misconception of the way military versus private vehicles are used?
WP3AB has a comment. Yeah, Ken. Well, yeah, SpaceX was the first one to be able to do that successfully from an orbiting spacecraft. To launch a vehicle into orbit, he was able to take that booster and land it on an autonomous drone ship or back at land. One of the first people to actually launch into space and then do the same, but it was a suborbital flight, was Blue Origin. He did that in Texas. He still does it with the New Shepard vehicle. He hasn't put people on that yet, but he's got plans on eventually maybe sending passengers up on this thing.